The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Alexandra Jackson of Rathbones. So welcome, Alexandra.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for having me back.
Nice, delighted to have you. I know we've had a few technical issues this morning, so apologies everyone for our lateness, our tardiness. But more importantly, sort of like stepping back and looking at the sort of macro, we've had a lot of uncertainty caused by the America First strategy, Trump's trade tariffs, Ukraine, Doge, and Gaza. So putting all that uncertainty together, which has impacted consumer and business confidence. What's your sort of outlook for equities for the rest of the year?
Yeah, it's a good place to start. I guess it hasn't probably gone exactly how most people and probably how President Trump would like it to go. But actually, I think, you know, for us sitting in the UK, maybe this is a good time for investors to start considering an alternative. You know, there wasn't really much incentive to consider an alternative when you're thinking about where to allocate your capital over the last couple of years. But now with the NASDAQ, you know, more broadly, US tech off double digits, actually, maybe this is a good time. You know, all of this sort of tariff chaos, DeepSeek, I don't think we can underestimate DeepSeek's impact on this. It's just reminded the market that, you know, passive inflows into large caps are not a one-way bet. Who knew? And actually that having some diversification in the portfolio is really sensible. Something that I know, you know, you and your listeners are very attuned to, but clearly some people in the market have forgotten this, I guess. So far, in this sort of rotation that we've seen, it's definitely been Europe and large caps more broadly that have kind of seen the inflows and benefited. But actually, you know, you can see a huge catch-up opportunity in mid caps from here. Normally, when sterling is very strong, which it is at the moment, it's up about 6.5% this year off the lows. That's a big move in FX. That's a huge signal to start thinking about your domestic weighting again. So normally this, you know, strong sterling comes with really strong mid-cap outperformance. I think for now, probably higher rates are slightly keeping a lid on this trade, and that general more risk-off sentiment tends to keep people more focused on that, on those sort of liquid large caps. But we think as our companies, you know, the ones that we're focused on, those kind of really quality, high quality growing mid caps, as they can continue to deliver this year, and as long as they can deliver the numbers and operationally, they could have a brilliant year. You know, there's lots of scope for multiple expansion, which there isn't in many markets, that's for sure. And then the key, I think, will be finding that earnings growth. That will be what really drives shorter term return. I guess really small caps and AIM, I'm still a bit worried about. Liquidity is difficult. There's a sort of regulatory worry, I guess, around AIM or sort of tax treatment worry. And generally in really, really small caps, you know, that interest cost can very quickly overwhelm your profit line. it can turn very quickly if you see an aggressive easing cycle. But mid caps, to me, have that sort of that sweet spot. They've got the valuation opportunity, but where we can find the resilience and consistency that I think we do need at this point in the cycle.
Great. Well, let's move to one stock in particular. It seems to be in that perfect sweet spot, sort of mid cap, UK, got a lot of IP, and in a sector that is booming at the moment, is defence company Chemring, which sort of like has a number of different parts to it. It's got the traditional sort of flares and decoys, but also has munitions, which I think it's building and putting a lot of investment in as the European responds to its requirements on under NATO. And obviously, it's got that cyber security division with Rogue. The shares have recovered quite a lot just of late. What's your sort of your latest thoughts on it?
Yeah, this is definitely a space that is really in the spotlight at the moment, isn't it, with European rearmament. And Chemring is one of the purest defence plays out there. So that, you know, really puts a highlight on it, I think. As you say, they've got the energetics and countermeasures piece, which is explosives, rocket motors, warheads, igniters, things like that. Countermeasures, infrared decoy flares against heat-seeking missiles. You know, we're really at the sharp end of what's happening at the moment. They have a factory in Norway called Chemring Nobel. They produce very advanced explosives. So it's kind of TNT-like products, but they are less sensitive. So they're less likely to detonate unexpectedly. They're quite difficult to manufacture, as you can imagine. They're used very widely in the Ukrainian war. And we've got stockpiles, NATO stockpiles, very, very low. And actually, the Norwegian government have helped to fund some of the expansion of this factory in Norway. So obviously, that's a great signal of you know, confidence and intent from a government player. But it also helps with the return on capital calculation in Chemring. And that is, I think that's a bit of a bugbear for investors in defence companies, that because of the capital intensity, because they have so many government customers, typically, you don't always get that high return that quality investors are looking for. So when you see the capital expenditure being shared between Chemring and someone else, that's a really good signal. And then, as you say, you've got that that piece in Rope, the cybersecurity piece, that's kind of the jewel in the crown. It's quite difficult to get a handle on exactly what's going on there. I don't have you know, clearance to get down to Rome, so I've never been able to go there. But it largely services the UK. It's kind of national security, very high tech stuff. So you've got this mix of, you know, a resurgent demand for traditional defence capabilities. Chemring have got nice exposure to Europe, which is important because that seems to be where the defence spend is going to be. So you've got amazing visibility at the moment. They've put out a very punchy 2030 target of having £1 billion+ pounds of revenue.
Which is about double, isn't it? Just a perspective, that's about double current levels.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, they're obviously seeing a huge kind of medium to long term opportunity. The valuation isn't very demanding as far as I can see. They suspended or cancelled their buyback in December this year without sort of saying exactly why or without hinting as to what they would do with any of that capital that they saved. And I think that made investors a little bit nervous. It sort of took the shine off the shares a little bit. But they've rallied, as you can see, they've rallied so aggressively this year, partly because they've reinstated the buyback, but also they had a potential bid. The company haven't said anything official about it, but they had a mooted bid at 390 from private equity. And, you know, from conversations I had with in the market, you know, people were saying this has to start with a 5 or a 6, even to want the board to start engaging. So you can see the huge kind of value that people place on this kind of business. It's up nearly 40% in the last 12 months, but we see a lot more value in the name.
Yeah, well, we got a question from John actually earlier this morning, because I don't know if you noticed, but other defense services company Kinetic came out with a profit warning, reduced its guidance by 15% for this year and for next year, largely on the back of short term volatility of order flow coming from the UK MOD and the US DOD. And the question he had, is there any read across from the kinetic profit warning and the short-term outlook to the rogue business for Chemring?
Well, I think, yeah, it does definitely highlight the lumpiness of orders in defence. And, you know, that is partly why people, you know, haven't invested in these businesses in size over the years, because they're so capital intensive, because they can be lower margin because of their customers, and because, you know, those contracts can be very lumpy. Kinetic has a big US presence, and so that does leave it, you know, that does leave it a bit more vulnerable, possibly to kind of spending changes there. And we know that the MOD, you know, that we've got spending reviews going on. It's not kind of smooth sailing in the government at the moment. So, but, you know, when I think about Chemring, they are, you know, they've got that big £1 billion order book target out there, or revenue target out there. But even they are saying, you know, in the short term, don't bring this forward too soon. This isn't going to happen right now. Projects, these factories, they are long duration. So, you know, you could have this sort of slight air pocket where these names have re-rated a lot, trying to price in this huge amount of spend, but actually you don't get the profits, you know, quarter on quarter. So, you know, if you're looking for kind of loads of operational delivery this quarter and next quarter, then the defence companies can be a harder place to be. But over the long term, you can see that that structural driver really is being reinforced.
Yeah, well, really well done on that one. Excellent pick. OK, let's move to one a bit smaller, which does have sort of like maybe some nearer term catalysts. It's Flavours and Fragrances Food Group, Treat, which is a sort of natural sort of citrus other flavours, basically for drinks, all natural, benefiting by that sort of move from the younger generation to healthier drinking. It's the shares have come off a lot since everybody was locked down. They've got a new CEO, David Shannon, and it does seem to have got a bit of a turnaround. How do you see this one going forward? Quite interesting, about 14 times PE for a really high quality stock.
Yeah, it has been disappointing, I must say. It's quite small now. It's 230 million market cap, I think. So it's definitely vulnerable to falling into that kind of, it's too small for a lot of people to buy, which is a shame because, as you say, it's got some kind of great market positions. They manufacture and supply natural ingredients, that is their focus, and extracts for largely for the beverage industry, but kind of broadly flavor and fragrance. So they get that exposure to strong trends across lots of different categories, as you say, people drinking less alcohol, maybe more those kind of flavored fruit drinks. Cold brew coffee has been huge. And they're going through this, you know, sort of transformation process from more of a kind of citrus oil trading company into those more higher margin categories like the tea, the health and wellness. You know, what's really important to Treat is sugar reduction, or helping its customers to reduce the sugar content in their drinks, but still provide the flavor and what they call mouthfeel, which is what makes the drinks, you know, so appealing.
Never heard it called mouthfeel before, but
yeah, it's that sort of, it's the feeling that you get from the sugar. So the sugar is the smell and the taste, but it also, they tell me, has an important feel when you're drinking it. So that's the kind of really difficult thing to replicate. And they've been able to do that very successfully. So they've got this really interesting portfolio. They have a lot of capacity in their manufacturing sites now. So I think if they can pull off filling that capacity, the incremental returns will be huge. You know, they don't need to add in too much more capex. They've already done a huge capex program in the UK and the US. So they've kind of future-proofed the business. They've got some interesting options in China as well, where, you know, their customers are just enormous. You know, they dwarf the kind of big customers that we think about in the West. So I think there's lots to go for. A new CEO, you know, often kind of comes in and changes things. I was sort of reassured by his comments that it's largely kind of tweaking around the edges because they've got these, you know, brilliant products, lots of capacity, and some really good customer relationships. So they've got net cash now on the balance sheet as well, or they're just about, I think, to flip back into net cash.
So that's right. Gives
them a bit more optionality. And I think some kind of shareholder return program would really support the shares here.
Good. What do you think some of the top line growth could get to? I mean, are we talking a GDP type grower, or are we actually, because it's a natural ingredients provider and it might win more market share, it could be a sort of like high single digits or...
Yeah, exactly. They guide to kind of 5-7%, which I think is doable. There's a little wrinkle at the moment with the orange juice price. So orange juice futures are a wonderful thing to track if you fancy that. And they've come off a lot. They've almost halved, I think, in the last sort of this year, which is quite difficult to get a handle on how that actually impacts Treatt, because they sort of tend to just pass that through. So as the orange oil price comes off, you get lower revenue, but actually it could be accretive to margin. So we'll see how that pans out. But it's not been the orange juice price hasn't come off because of lack of demand. It's actually because the price has been very high recently due to a citrus disease called greening, which has affected the crop, particularly in Florida. So there's quite a lot to watch in this company, and I think that's maybe, you know, what puts people off sometimes.
Okay, good. Sides. Brilliant. Okay, if anybody wants to ask Alexandra any questions, please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. We got one from Ben Sharman. He's asking about, in the same sector, all natural sort of tonics and ginger ale. We've got Fever Tree, which recently just inked a massive deal out in the States with, I think, was it Mawson Coors? So
Coors, exactly.
Yeah, and it's just really sort of what your thoughts are. It was a darling. The shares have come off a lot, and how you see this one going forward.
Yeah, it's a huge change to the sort of outlook for the stock here, I think, and you can probably see it, in the share price there. So Mawson Coors, you know, big US beer company, they are going to acquire 9% stake in Fever Tree, and that will give them exclusive commercialization rights to Fever Tree's US portfolio. And that really changes things a lot. It gives Fever Tree this huge distribution network where the Molson Coors distribution network will be visiting on-trade and off-trade sites multiple times a day or a week, compared to what Fever Tree have been able to do kind of on their own and with their previous distributor, Southern Glazers. So I think this could be really game-changing to the revenue growth in Fever Tree US, which is, I think, why a lot of people are still in the stock. Mm. The UK business is quite mature, gin and tonic, you know, possibly peaked. So we do need, the story is very much about the US growth. And where they're hugely successful, and it's not so much tonic, it's, as you say, ginger beer, that's a very popular drink. The Paloma is hugely popular still, which is tequila and sparkling grapefruit juice, a delicious drink, very Instagrammable because it's sort of pale pink. So that's the sort of, that's the new Aperol, I would say. And Fever Tree have got a great position there. So, don't think about it as tonic water and worry that, Americans don't drink G&T in the way that we do here. It's a much broader portfolio. But it probably does mean slightly lower margin from the US business, because they've got to share the profit with Molson Coors. So there's a bit of, kind of working out what that does. But essentially, people are in this for the US growth opportunity, and this supercharges the US growth opportunity. And then, of course, if you've taken 9%, a 9% stake, there's always the chance of taking a possibly 100% stake, or, taking the business off the UK public markets. Which at this valuation, makes sense to me.
Yeah. Is there any tariff risk at all? Because I know we've got Diageo, which is a much bigger spirits business, and it imports, I think, a lot of stuff into the States, things like whiskey from, I think, Canada, and from tequila in Mexico. But is there any sort of like potential exposure here for product going into the States from Fever Tree, or is it all made locally?
Well, this actually is much better for them, because now they will be able to bottle it. Molson will be bottling the products in the US for Fever Tree, rather than at the moment a lot of it is produced and then shipped over to the US, which, potentially, depending on what happens with tariffs, could expose them to more tariff risk. So I think, from that point of view, it's all a lot more future proofing. Diageo are, looking at ways to reduce their tariff risk by kind of maybe trunking in the alcohol from Canada or Mexico directly into the US and then bottling it there. But, this is huge potential disruption for anyone with a big supply chain like that.
Yeah, I did actually see, it was quite interesting, on the Diageo call, the analyst call, that their biggest growth driver, I mean, they're not as big a grower as Fever-Tree are, but their biggest growth driver was smaller packs and splitting stuffed whiskies and cocktails down into smaller. So this should play to that trend of having sort of like ready-to-drink product, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they talked, didn't they, about Don Julio, particularly the really, really premium tequila, where the, you know, the large format bottles sell for hundreds of pounds. So if you can reduce that format size down to kind of 50, then people who really value being seen with that premium product can still access it, but just at a lower absolute price point. But that, you know, that does talk to a consumer under pressure. That is such a big driver. So I think we do have to think about that. And then the other driver that they talked about is Guinness Zero, which is hugely important. And again, talks to that, you know, wellness theme and young people drinking less, which, you know, the market has very polarized views on, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to stick to my cheap and nasty Prosecco, I think, which will be fine. Okay, let's move to a different sector in construction, but equally moving into the States. Buy and build company, Breedon, which does aggregates and asphalt and very, very successful business model in the UK and Ireland, and made a big acquisition, I think, about this time last year out in the States. And then there's made another one, I think, before the year end as well. How do you see this one? It's come from nowhere to now be in the FTSE 250.
Yeah, it's really good. We've owned this for so many years, and we really liked the, you know, when we first bought it, it was about that roll up, about buying smaller quarries and cement businesses and, you know, adding them in. It was a really, you know, it's been a really strong story.
It looks as though it's had a bid out actually this morning, Alexander. I'm just seeing the shares, if this is right, are up 38%. Is that correct? I know, is that correct? That seems like, wow, it's just moonshotted. You might need to crack open that Don Julio tequila this afternoon if you're right. Is that correct?
I'm not seeing that on my screen, but
Okay. Well, maybe I've jumped the boat there, but I didn't. It certainly wasn't a moment ago. Well, it wasn't like anyway. What the hell?
I hope you're right. Maybe it's a fat finger. I don't know.
Yes.
But it definitely could get bid for. I think it's quite cheap. It's on kind of 13 times. You know, you never see these aggregates businesses trading on a huge multiple. But when you look at some of the US names, CRH, Martin Marietta, Vulcan, you know, much, much bigger sort of solution led businesses, but still playing in the same space, they trade on, you know, kind of closer to 16 times. So, or actually much higher for Martin. So room definitely to re-rate. As you say, they've now got this US business. So I think what they're trying to do is replicate the strategy that they had in the UK, in GB, Great Britain and Ireland, which has been so good for shareholder returns over the years. But they have recognised that, you know, GB has been so, so tough. We saw them last week, actually, and they said that ready mix volumes in GB are back to 1960s levels. So we really do have a problem with house building and construction in this country. But there's no, it's not like there's an alternative at the moment to concrete. So if you want to build things, you will need concrete. So you can see that a really quite a small increase in new build housing, construction starts or infrastructure spend, that could make a huge difference to the GB business. But I think that's great, and that could lead to upgrades. But the most exciting part is definitely the US. They bought the business in Missouri last year, and then they've added another larger business in Missouri called Lionmark. They're talking about synergies, you know, cost synergies in that business, but also which they, you know, typically got in the GB and Ireland businesses, which is the revenue synergies of being able to use their own aggregates and ready mix and things in, you know, cross selling it into the other bits of the business. So that should be, you know, I would expect that to be, you know, very successful, as they've typically done in the past. Missouri is a good state to start in for sure, but I think they will spread out into Texas, where Lionmark has a little presence as well. Missouri, it's a red state. lots of infrastructure projects going on there. You know, Trump is a build guy, build, build, build. That is his motto. He wants to do this. So it's well funded at a kind of federal level, but also Missouri specifically has a state gas tax, and it can only be spent on improving highways. A novel idea, perhaps something we can think about here.
Yes.
But so that's, you know, that's at a state level. So that really protects the spend there. So, you know, I think they've done a really good job in focusing on a state like that. But yeah, I'm going to watch and see if that's this morning.
Yeah, no, apologies. I think I got your heart rate, pulse rating mistakenly here, because I was just checking another one, and it does seem as though it's the correct price, but the chart is wrong. It should have actually, it's been moving up. I don't know why there's a mistake. It never normally is, but the price is right. It's 480, but the chart seems to be wrong, but apologies.
Well, one day probably.
It is, yes. it's done very well for you. We've got a follow-up question on that same sector from Lennon Physical. He's asking, have you ever had a look at Sigma Rock, who I think is similar type of business in Lyme, I believe, and they came out with some pretty good results this morning.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, I thought the numbers were fine this morning. Yeah, we have had a look at it in the past. For me, Breeden had that sort of track record. I like that the guys who run it are very operational. The Sigma Rock management team are much more, it's a bit more around that kind of financial engineering. So I felt more confident in the guys with the sort of, I guess, operational skill set as well. It was a bit smaller. But yeah, we have definitely had a look at it in the past. But for me, Breeden has a nicer now geographic mix as well. And yeah. Sigma Rock, with that, they did a very, very, very big acquisition at one point. And that can, you know, it can go one of two ways, can't it? So,
yeah.
But good. Yeah, you can see that. Yeah.
Okay, good. We've got another one, just asking in the same sector, Truss. He's asking about just the brickmakers in general. Have you had a look at those? We've got Ipstock, Fortira, and I think he owns Brickability. Any thoughts on any of those at all?
Yeah, again, you know, a tiny increase in volume there could really drive material profits. They have also come to the end. Both of them, I think, have come to the end of some CapEx plans. So, you know, it's not like they'd have to front load CapEx in order to benefit from those volumes. So it's a very it's a very high beta way to play an increase in volumes. And you don't have to take the price risk that you would do in, you know, the house price risk that you would do in a house builder. So it's a kind of, you know, it's a different way to play that. But yeah, I would be pretty interested in that space. You just, you know, the risk is, and we all know this in the UK, the government says they're going to ease planning. It's very difficult. There's a reason why it hasn't happened in years and years, and why housing starts are so low. It's not that this is particularly easy. Actually, when we saw Breeden, we talked to them about this and said, have you seen any signs of kind of ungumming this planning process? And they said, well, there's definitely willingness there, but we physically don't have the right number of people employed in planning divisions within councils to actually okay these plans. So you can say that you want to speed it up till you're blue in the face, but if you don't have the people to do the stamping and the ticking and, you know, all that stuff, then it can be quite difficult. So it's not just a case of, you know, a government minister saying this is going to be easier from now on.
Yeah.
But if they can achieve something, then this sector will really race away.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I don't believe how many M&A activity we've got on this call just this morning. We've got Ben Sharman saying, apparently Green Core has formally made a bid now for Bakkavor this morning. And just any thoughts on that? And likewise, I know you own Cranswick, which is the pig and poultry sort of like producer and stuff in that particular sector. But any thoughts at all?
Yeah, so Green Core for Bakkavor slightly surprised me, I would say. I sort of thought they'd be doing maybe smaller kind of infills. But look, this would give them massive scale in the industry. They would be, you know, taking out a competitor. It would give them a broader range of products. So Green Core are mostly sandwiches. They do salads, sushi. I actually went to their capital markets day a couple of weeks ago and had a very nice award-winning, I think it's an Aldi lasagna, which is genuinely one of the nicest things I've had in ages. They make products for Greggs. They make poke bowls for supermarkets. They do the Katsu Sambo for M&S, which is a chicken katsu sandwich. So, you know, a huge range of things in the food to go space. But if they bought back of all that, would add things like desserts and a kind of, you know, to really round out that product set. So that could be interesting. I think they can go it alone, though. I'm not sure that they definitely need this. They've got capacity. They at the Capital Markets Day, they also showed us some really interesting technology that they've put in, a bit like Cranswick, where, you know, making sandwiches and wraps is very manual still. It is quite hard to automate, but they've been working with OEM providers to work on, they have a wrap cutter, rather than the operatives, you know, taking these huge knives and slicing the wraps on the diagonal. They've now got a laser wrap cutter. They've also got a machine, which, I mean, this is incredible. It takes the lid of the sandwich, flips it over, puts it on the sandwich, then cuts it on the diagonal and flips it over so that you get those two little triangles ready to put in the box. You know, this stuff is quite hard. Obviously, it's a lot easier with the manual dexterity for a human to do that. But if you can reduce some cost in that business, take out some of that labor cost, which is becoming more expensive, something we're talking to Cranswick about as well. Increasing automation should lead to some nice cost saves. Cranswick, that's just a beautiful chart, isn't it? Top, bottom,
it is, yeah.
Bottom,
you're right. You're in a fantastic job, aren't you? You get to taste these sort of the tequilas and the mixers, and then to taste all the food. It's sort of like a mix between sort of like product quality testing and or consumer testing, and actually obviously putting all the getting the financial returns as well. Perfect.
Exactly. It's not all super glamorous though. The Cranswick factory, I must say, the kind of the sausage factory, you will never get that smell out of your nostrils. So it's it's not all glamour and the aggregates site visit, you know, to the quarry. But this is, you know, Cranswick is a phenomenal capital allocator. They've taken what is, you know, not a hugely high margin business and managed to create very accretive returns, brilliant capital allocation. They've generated £1 billion of cash over the last 5 to 6 years or so. So they can do CapEx, they can invest in that automation piece to reduce their labor bill. They've managed to do little bits of M&A and shareholder returns, and they're still in net cash. So, you know, this is just an absolute machine. I think it's still quite underappreciated. Historically, you know, a bit like Treat, I suppose, this was a pass-through commodity business, but geared to pig prices. So there we could track pig futures. They're no longer just pork specialists, but it's more diversified. They've got the poultry side as well, and some more kind of food to go as well, you know, deli items. They even do pet food, and they've just invested in a pig genetics business. So thinking about the sorts of things that Genus have been doing over the years. So I want to hear more about that. I think they've got a Capital Markets Day this week as well. So that will be really interesting to hear. We've been thinking about that this morning, though, because Asda have announced that they are going to invest some more into, well, invest profit into growing their top line, which essentially means a price war is coming in the UK supermarket space. Cranswick don't have a huge exposure to Asda, more into the other supermarkets, but again, something to think about when 75% of their volumes go into the UK retail channel.
Yeah, it's quite interesting though, isn't it? Because I mean, you've got Cranswick, Bakkavor, and Greencore. All those charts are fantastic.
Fantastic, yeah. I think people are a bit snooty about them because they are a bit low margin. But it's you know, if you can get the capital allocation right, then you've got a great recipe for shareholder returns there.
Yeah. Good. Okay, let's move. Yeah. Cool. Let's move sectors. We've got a really cheap stock. We've got, which is unusually so, is Everplay, which is the former Team 17, does sort of online games development for third parties, but also does its own one. I couldn't believe it. It's got a good, strong balance sheet, plenty of cash, and it trades on about less than 10 times forward PE. What am I missing? It's supposed to be a growth company, this. It's trading like a flipping, you know, sort of small cap, sort of like declining iceberg.
I know. Well, it is a small cap now. It's 300 million. It's AIM listed, which is, you know, it's been difficult. I think flows and liquidity are, you know, are a concern for people in companies like this. But as you say, this is a business in a growth sector, you know, producing independent video games, indie video games, we call them. They've got a great back catalogue. This is what we like about Team 17, is that it's not just about the game, you know, the blockbuster game that they produced this year. It's about all the games that they've produced before. And what they're really good at is managing those so that you still, they're still generating revenue. That horrible share price decline there was when they had a profit warning in, is that 2022, I think?
Yeah, end of 2023 it is, yeah.
Yeah, and they, exactly. And they've basically been overspending on bigger and bigger games. So I think they, you know, it's a bit of sort of management hubris, possibly, where you have a lot of success and you start thinking, oh, well, you know, look how much revenue we made from that game. I wonder if we could make even more, if we'd spent even more. But actually, the, you know, the secret sauce, the great success of Team 17 and the reason we bought it at IPO, again, was the commitment they made never to spend more than £1 million developing a game and to really sit in that indie game space rather than trying to move up into the AAA space, which is, you know, dominated by incredibly well-funded, huge, experienced AAA developers. So they kind of got themselves in the wrong part of the market. They've got a new CEO in now who doesn't have the, you know, he's no Debbie. She was absolutely amazing, but he is more focused on getting back into that indie game space, reducing the amount they spend on each project, being a bit more sort of financially strict, I guess. They brought in a new chairman as well, Frank from Codemasters. He was, I think, the CEO at Codemasters, which was the F1 video game that was, again, eventually sold. So, you know, could this company be vulnerable as well on 9x? 100%, I think it could be vulnerable. That back catalogue would be extremely attractive to a lot of people. I'm excited that they can see some earnings growth coming through this year. They've got a bit of positive momentum by, you know, refocusing on the games where they have history and where they have a right to win. There's a game that they released in February called Sworn, which is a sort of, it's a King Arthur type one to four player game, and that's getting great engagement. So, but again, you know, you don't have to have these new games selling brilliantly for Team 17 to work. It's also about that back catalogue.
How do they make money out of the back catalogue? Is it sort of like a subscription basis, or is it basically just people just keep buying King Arthur and his, you know, set eight knights or whatever it is, or his hotcake?
Yeah, and it's, you know, they're very cheap, these games. They don't cost a lot. My kids are always buying them. You know how it is when you sort of want these snackable games, which you don't play for hours and hours. It's not like Fortnite. You don't play them for hours. You'll play them for a few hours. But Team 17 are also really good at lifecycle management, so they will release downloadable content that you then pay for, and that kind of upgrades your experience within the game. And they're really, really good at that. And it's across the platforms as well. So Nintendo, you'd have PC, mobile. So they sort of release them at different stages.
And all of their back catalogue is their own games, because they also do for other third parties, don't they? It's a mix. And if you add up all their recurring revenue and their back catalogue, what sort of percentage of their total turnover it is? Because I meant their total turnover is about 165 or 166 million.
Yeah, it's probably around 80%, 75-80%, I would say. Yeah.
God,
that really is hugely important. And that game Worms that they launched in, I think, 1995, they still make, you know, a million odd of revenue, or maybe more than that. I forget the exact number. But, you know, that just shows you how good they are at managing those games through a really, really long period of time. They've got Hell Let Loose, which is probably one of their most successful games, which is a kind of first-person shooter game, Second World War. And that was released many, many years ago, and they're still managing that really well.
Fabulous. Okay, let's switch sectors, more infrastructure. We've got a company that's converting into REIT, which had a lot of questions on the podcast or the video I did on Friday, Grainger, which is the UK's largest private residential landlord. Got two parts of the business. It's by doing a lot of build to rent, which is like purpose-built housing blocks for people that seems to be going very well, large, big pipeline going forward. And then it's got this what they call it, I think, reversionary portfolio, which is the regulated tenancies they're selling off as people, you know, unfortunately, you know, they all die through old age, and then they can then release those capital. How do you see this one? The shares are trading at round about £2, but the EPRA is £3, and I think the net assets just on a book value are about £2.50 or something.
Yeah, so huge discount, 30% discount to the NAV. I think the REIT conversion in October this year will save them, you know, the corporation tax. So that should be, I think that should really highlight even more value in the stock. It's a ridiculous discount. This is a fantastic business, as you say, the UK's largest listed provider of private rental homes in the UK. They've got 11,000 homes, a pipeline of another 5,000 build-to-rent homes to come. And then the other 20% is that regulated tenancy, which is individual homes on controlled rents, submarket rents, where the occupants have the right to live in the properties for life. But as you say, when they die, they revert to Grainger, and then Grainger will sell them. I think people have been a bit suspicious that they wouldn't be able to actually extract the value from the regulated tenancy portfolio, but they consistently sell those above book value. So I don't think there's a story there at all. They use that capital, as you say, to then reinvest in the higher growth build-to-rent pipeline. These business, these tower flat blocks are amazing. They are... if you think about a very modern student accommodation block, which is, you know, lots of little units, but then with some communal space as well, Grainger has sort of followed that model and definitely appeals to people who are, you know, young professionals who are probably, you know, just out of student accommodation. So it sort of eases their shift into adulting, another phrase that my children talk about all the time. And it makes it easier because all your bills are included, your Wi-Fi, you know, all of those things, which I guess can feel a bit overwhelming when you first kind of launch yourself into the private rental market. So Grainger's taking care of a lot of that for you through their platform, which is a huge driver of operational efficiency. I think that it gives them the platform as well. They could, you know, they could license that to other people who need to operate a similar kind of platform. But these flats are amazing. You have, you know, your own reasonably small flat, but then there's, you know, there's communal dining spaces that you can book out, a dining room to have your friends over. There's communal workspace. So if you work from home, it's not like, you know, you have to sort of work from the end of the kitchen table anymore. You could go into the communal workspace. There's Wi-Fi and all of those things included. They have spare rooms in some of them. So if, you know, if your family come to stay, you can book a spare room, which is, you know, it's just all so much more efficient than, you know, kind of having to rent somewhere bigger all the time that you maybe can't afford. Rental growth is what drives the profits. That's linked to wage inflation. That's been kind of 3 to 3.5%. That should continue over time.
Just on that rental growth, the currently in the UK, not at Grainger, but it's 1% is the latest, I think. And that's, is there any debt exposure there if it does actually go negative, Frey, for instance?
Well, I think the places where they have exposure, you know, London and other big kind of conurbations gives them a bit of protection from that. But then, you know, so much is coming from that new build pipeline as well. So it's not about that like for like rental growth, but they have done, you know, market leading rental growth. You've got such big supply and demand imbalances in the residential market, massive undersupply of housing, obviously, and you've got small landlords exiting the market in droves at the moment because it's so difficult to own and run these buy-to-lets on a small scale and make a profit. It's just very stressful. The cost of home ownership now exceeds the cost of renting, so that, you know, that's another driver for them, and I think they're really in this sweet spot. They really understand their target market and what they're looking for, and you often see, you know, Grainger people who are renting a Grainger property will move into another Grainger property, so they, you know, you kind of capture them for a longer period of time, which again helps the like for like rental growth as well.
We've got a follow-up question from Marking Trader. He's asking about whether Grainger could be a takeover candidate from a large insurance company, a big infrastructure player like Blackstone, or even a, you know, bank wealth manager like Lloyds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. And on a 30% discount to NAV, you know, why not? We're seeing so much activity in the real estate space at the moment. Yeah. Warehouse REIT has been bid for. I think it was Assura last week. You know, it's just almost every week we see another company being bid for, because these, you know, you can see that the interest rate cycle is topping out for sure, and these NAVs haven't, these discounts to NAV haven't started closing yet. Yeah. So yeah, they definitely look vulnerable. It would be a shame, because I think Grainger have put so much into this, and they're, you know, they're really, their results are just unimpeachable. So it'd be a shame for them to not sort of get the benefit of it, get the spoils of it. But that's the market.
Yeah. Just on Warehouse REIT, Ben Sharman's just got a follow-up. He's saying he reckons you own it. And if you do, and I don't know whether you can say it yet because it's maybe confidential, but he's wondering whether, are you supporting the buyout for Warehouse REIT, or is it still something in work in progress?
I think that's a work in progress. I think we can do better on the price.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Okay, well, that says everything. Right. let's move to, we've got another one in that sector. We've got Volution, which came out with results last week. Extractor Fan seems to be really not putting a foot wrong, benefiting from increasing regulation, better people wanting better indoor air quality, particularly actually the social housing and affordable housing, where they've had so many problems with mold, etc. How do you see this one going forward? It's just done perfectly.
Yeah, what a great business. I mean, don't get too excited about Extractor Fans. it's pretty wicked stuff. They've got these, you know, great structural growth drivers, shortage of homes, obviously, on the one hand, then the consumer behavior around indoor air quality awareness, and then those regulatory drivers, which just don't show any signs of slowing down. So you've got that organic growth driver, and then they're also able to do M&A because they've got great cash conversion, which allows them to have that optionality. So they've rolled up they've started rolling up the European market, which is quite fragmented. They've done some stuff in New Zealand. They've just done their largest ever deal. They did that at the back end of last year, I think, which is called Fantech. So great to see. You know, you're always a little bit nervous after a big deal gets done, that it, you know, can take management bandwidth away, or they can kind of take their eye off the ball because they're so excited about their new toy. So it was great to see last week that guidance was held. The CFO here is fantastic. You've got this great double act of Ronnie, the CEO, who's brilliant at kind of selling the story and getting us excited and finding these great deals, I think, and selling the Volution story to the businesses he wants to acquire. And then an exceptionally strong CFO in Andy, who, and so he commented last week, he told us what the return on invested capital would have been without the deal. So if they hadn't done Fantech, so kind of organic ROIC. I mean, this is just, it's a bit niche-y, but this is such high quality behavior from the CFO. It tells us what's going on inside the rest of the business, aside from the deal. It gives us really good signals in terms of working capital, capital allocation, all those things. And again, when management are very busy, that's a great thing to hear. So we'd love to see more of our companies talking about that, because we always worry. And there are so many examples, aren't there, that companies do big deals, particularly overseas, and then it just goes wrong. And there are just countless examples of how that happens. And I think ROIC, organic ROIC, post-deal is a really interesting signpost.
Was it pre-deal and post? So I guess on this quality business, it's 25% plus, isn't it, the ROIC?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And in terms of the rating, their closest peer is a European company called System Air, which trades on about 17 times. So that's where we're thinking for Volution as well. But I think they can grow into this multiple. Definitely. They've got, you know, they can pay down the debt now post the Fantech deal, prove out that margin story, and then reinvest more into the M&A. There's a good ESG story here as well, because their plastic materials are 85% recycled, which is, you know, great for investors to see, but also drives consumer behavior. Some clients aren't just focused on price for their bathroom fan. They want that element as well.
Yeah, well, as I say, it's hugely important, particularly if they're going to carry on building out social housing and to get the right air quality to stop the mold. And unfortunately, you do get people, you know, babies dying and stuff. OK, let's move sectors. We've got AB Dynamics, which over the long term, it's basically a testing of all things, automotive, got track testing, simulation, bringing new cars to market, new products, things like assisted driving. So it's in a good space. Automotive has been struggling, particularly on the EV side. When you look at the chart long term, it's been an incredible winner. So a big tip of the hat there. But what's the sort of the view going forward?
Yeah, so I think the important thing for AB, oh gosh, it's lovely, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's not done a lot, has it, in the last couple of years? But this is such an interesting story. So it's not linked to volumes of cars sold, luckily. It's linked to new models released. Mm. And the one thing we know, when the auto market is tough, or when any market is tough, what manufacturers will do is try and offer more models to get people excited about it. So that's a really nice way to protect yourself. They supply all the top automotive manufacturers, tier one suppliers, service providers as well. So again, you get that, a bit like Volution, you get that lovely mix of regulatory tailwinds, the technology change. And then the key for me with AB Dynamics, which I don't think is really reflected in this share price chart here, but this was a kind of founder run business before AB, Anthony Best. Since the new CEO and CFO have come in, who we knew the CFO from her work at Avon Technologies before, and we've sort of followed her around, a really, really impressive CFO, very focused on cash conversion. And I think what the CEO and CFO have done, kind of professionalizing and strengthening the operational and commercial platform, has really set this company up for that. You know, 10% organic growth, a little bit of M&A, quite smart M&A they've been doing, operating margin above 20%. You know, you can justify quite a premium multiple on that basis.
Yeah. Is there any danger? This is more holistic type of thing. Any danger that obviously you've got Trump and now you've got the UK quite making sounds they're aggressively going to roll back regulation, whether they do or not is another case of this. But is there any exposure, sort of like if you're in regulated businesses or businesses that are supported by regulation, that you start seeing a softening off of that? Because we did have an instance from Learning Technology Group, which had a big division supporting, it was the US government, and they rolled back some testing outfit in the States, the rules. Trump did the executive order, and automatically, immediately, its turnover went to zero because that was the test it was doing. I'm just guessing if you're in safety and crash dummy testing, you're probably okay. But any thoughts, just more sort of like holistically, more generally?
Yeah, no, I think you've hit the nail on the head. A bit like with Volution as well and AB Dynamics, you know, they're in safety. This is health and safety. This is people's lives on the line. Those NCAP tests. There are hundreds and hundreds of these regulations that cars have to go through. And actually in the US, they are starting on that journey of increasing regulations, because there's quite an obvious correlation between better regulation or more regulation and lower road deaths. Yeah. So I think that's pretty low down on the list of priorities of things to cut.
Yeah. OK, on the same tech theme, we've got Kainos, which is an IT supporter, got two divisions. It does a lot of sort of like a value added reseller for Workday software, huge success out in the States. And then it also does a lot of work for the UK government and public and private sectors, etc., just implementing digitization and stuff like this. It's struggled obviously a bit, or may struggle a bit going forward, because of if there's going to be cutbacks, certainly short term products. How do you see this one? It trades at I was just looking at the numbers. Oh, it's still on trough earnings. It's about 17 times actually, but a very strong balance sheet.
Yeah, I agree. Quite trophy earnings, 17 times compared to, you know, it's been over 30 times. That's been a kind of fairly consistent multiple. Probably we won't get back up to those lofty heights. That seems quite a kind of zero interest rate multiple, perhaps. But they build custom digital services platforms, particularly for the UK government. They've just won a new contract, 50 million contract with the MOD. So yes, there is a hiatus while this government kind of finds its feet, and they definitely weren't quite ready for for governing in July this year. So that's taken a bit longer, and the government spending review has been, I think, pushed back a little bit again. So definitely kind of short term pressure there. And a couple of weeks ago, Kainos came out and said they, you know, doing some cost cutting in order to kind of right size the business there. It's difficult in a professional services firm to right size the business when your top line is difficult. So I think they're doing the right things. They I guess the weakness in the stock correlates, unfortunately, with a change of CEO, where the old CEO retired. He actually did the IR function for a while, which I've never ever seen before in my life.
Sorry, you had the IR director stepping up to become the CEO.
No, you had the CEO stepping down
to become the IR director. Oh yeah, wow!
I think he was just helping out. You know, he's that kind of guy.
That is odd.
We've talked about this before, how kind of humble and normal he is for a, you know, hugely successful tech CEO. He's just incredibly humble. Anyway, it didn't go that well. I think the board were frustrated with the outgoing CEO and how I guess how responsive he was and how effectively they were going after these contracts, particularly with the government. And so the old CEO and IR director has actually come back into the business and is going to take the reins on again. So that's wonderful news. We have, you know, total faith in Brendan and that he can, you know, that he's got the capabilities to kind of turn this around and make those cost savings. So you've got these government bottlenecks for sure, but, you know, multi-year, this is about that long-term digital transformation, and that is unchanged. The government needs to save money on its manual processes, and Kainos is a great way to do that. The other thing that I saw the other day, which is interesting, is BJSS, which is one of their largest independent competitors. They are being bought by another larger firm. And so that often, particularly in professional services firms, that can cause a bit of hiatus and consultants move on and, you know, shop themselves around. So that probably gives Kainos a bit of breathing room as well in terms of winning some more contracts. Workday. The most interesting part of this business is Workday products, where they develop products that sit alongside Workday. So when you bring Workday, when you implement Workday, so Kainos, they don't just sell the software, they implement it. So typically when you put in a huge piece of enterprise software kit like that into your business, you would have a consultant come in and help you with that. A lot of times it would be the Big Four, but increasingly people want a Workday specialist, and Kainos is the leading European Workday specialist. So they will come in and help you to implement it. And what they've then also done is created this products group. So for example, they run a test that Workday is working perfectly every Sunday night. And then they've kind of modularized that and they've rolled that out. So they sell that now to Workday customers. And they've got all sorts of different ideas in there. They've got another one called Smart Audit. And they've got some big targets there around the ARR, annual recurring revenue, that they would expect to get from Workday products. So, and that obviously carries with it, you know, that's all software that carries with it a totally different multiple. So that's, you know, that's really interesting as well.
That's a really smart strategy, actually, because if Workday goes into lots of different companies across numerous different sectors, they'll have their different nuances of specialization that they need a bit of tailorization for their specifics, whether it's export, import, whatever it is. And therefore, if you put a service wrap or a software wrap over the top of it, the sticky revenue streams, it helps Workday and it helps you, because it means that they can't lift and shift Workday out of that property.
Exactly. Yeah. So Workday love it. But it's, you know, it's a tiny percentage of what you spend on the actual Workday product. But it just means that you know that it's running correctly and that it's, you know, doing what it's
It's great. That's a great idea. Okay, on the same tech theme, we had a successful IPO last year, which I see you've participated, Raspberry Pi, the low-cost sort of like computing platform that came out of for schools years ago, but now has moved into the sort of industrial arena and put a software wrap. I think it's the same sort of model as NVIDIA, but the shares have done well. They're trading at about 58 times actually next year. So how do you see this one? It's obviously, well, you know, people like it for lots of reasons.
Yeah, I get, wow. I don't think we can underestimate how important Raspberry Pi was for the UK market. So it listed in June.
Yeah.
We haven't had a float that's gone really well in quite some time. We haven't had any tech hardware in the UK either. You know, ARM was such a success story. So it's wonderful to see that we can do this, this tech hardware side. And great that they chose London to list. As you say, they started off life producing these single board computers, which are kind of low power requirement, quite simple, but low cost, high performance, modular computers that, you know, they can be really, really small or around this size or a little bit bigger. And they retail for kind of $5 all the way up to $80 and more. And you can customize them. So you build them up so you could attach monitors, keyboards, mouse, sensors, displays, all sorts of different things you can attach to them. And they started off life trying to teach kids, you know, how to build a computer from scratch. So the guy who set it up was frustrated that children were spending more time playing video games on their computers and not actually playing with their computers. And it made him kind of nervous about the future of computer science. So that's where he started. And lots of people's children will be familiar with the Raspberry Pi brand from using them at school. But then roll forward 20 years and those kids who started life playing on Raspberry Pi single board computers are now working in the engineering and research departments of huge global industrial businesses. And when they need a low cost, high performance, high power, low power requirement option, they've gone with Raspberry Pi. So you can see now over 70, nearly 80% of revenues actually come from this industrial sector, either where the industrial companies use Raspberry Pi in their own processes to check things. So there's a Japanese car manufacturer who makes a car every 20 seconds. When you're manufacturing things at that high level of speed and highly automated, you need to do a lot of testing to make sure the work that the line has done is correct. And you wouldn't want to stick, you know, very expensive computers all the way along the line. So you use a Raspberry Pi type solution. So either these companies use them in their processes, or they use them as components within the products that they actually end up selling. So kind of nicely designed in there. So they're really plugged into this industrial space, which is in growth mode. It's quite a unique edge AI play, where increasingly those high-end industrial AI applications will require sensing at the edge, which means you're making kind of real-time low latency decisions on localized AI models. Actually, DeepSeek could be run off a Raspberry Pi SCB. It would be slow. It may not be the most beautiful experience of running DeepSeek, but you could. So yeah. That kind of tells you a bit about where Raspberry Pi sits. And as you say, they're wrapping that semiconductor piece in. So I agree with you. The reason that, for example, Apple products are so stable and work so well is because Apple controls the hardware, the phone, and they control the software, the iOS. Yeah. And Raspberry Pi are kind of following a similar thing where they make the SCB, and typically they put a Broadcom chip in there, but now they're going to develop their own semiconductor chips as well. And so that should sort of stabilize and, you know, internalize some of that margin. So the shares have gone bananas. So they floated at £2.80 in June. Half of the fund managers who applied got zero allocation. So I think, you know, you can't underestimate how important allocating the shares to the right people is. If you give away your shares to hedge funds and then wonder why the shares have gone down 20% on day one, you know, I think
you did very well to get them then, Alexandra.
We did well. Well, we worked hard on the process. You know, we understand how that process works. It involves lots of engagement with management. It involves being a long-term sticky shareholder with the potential to add more to your stake. So I think, that really helps the Rathbones name. The work that we do helps there. And not being a shorting hedge fund helps too. But we waited. You know, you don't want to have too much in an IPO into their first set of results. Probably it can always be a slightly nerve-wracking moment. You know, you don't know how this management team guides or how they want to talk to the market or how well they understand what the market wants from them. So we didn't add to it until after the maiden numbers, which we were really happy with. They beat what we had expected. So we added to it then kind of around £3, £3.30. And then in December it doubled. I think by January it was seven, yes, got up to £7. So we've more than halved our holdings since then. As you say, it became, you know, it became very expensive. I think at one point it was 70 times, which makes it the Europe's most expensive semiconductor stock, and it's not yes, fully semiconductor stock. So we thought we'd take, you know, a nice big chunk out, use that capital to buy, you know, lower price things for sure, but also because you could, you know, you just know that that's going to give some back. So we haven't sold all of it. We'd happily go again. We really like where this company sits, but you know, valuation is important. And in the UK, you know, we think a lot about, do you run your winners or do you trim them? We are, we're much more in the camp of sort of lock in some profit from those things. Yeah. When you buy a stock and you think it's going to go up a lot and it goes up a lot, take the win. Yeah. And that's what we thought with Raspberry Pi.
Very well done. We've got a quick follow-up from Marking Trader. He's asking about whether Raspberry Pi does actually have any sort of like a source hardware manufacturer exposure to one like Broadcom. I'm guessing they don't, simply because they can swap in and out what they need, depending, they're not dependent on somebody.
Well, they are. They do mainly use Broadcom chips, but they, okay, you know, their strategy is to develop their own as well. Yeah, and okay, they're very focused on that supply chain. You know, a lot of their products are manufactured at a factory in Wales. So, you know, they kind of, yeah, they talk about that a lot and trying to make sure that they're mitigating those risks.
Okay, good. Let's move to online ID checking company, GB Group, which was an absolute darling years ago. And if you look at on the longer chart, the shares have still done well. They had a boom time during lockdown when everybody wanted to sign up to everything. So all the online providers were checking their ID that they were, you know, present and just, you know, correct people, right ages and stuff. And then the shares have come down a bit. What's your latest view on this one?
Yeah, for a long time, this was my biggest, you know, this is my kind of career best contributor to performance. And then they did this huge acquisition of a US company in whenever that is, right at the top of that kind of crypto cycle, unfortunately, and they paid way too much for it. And they didn't realize how much crypto revenue there was in there. And it took a long time, but eventually the CEO moved on, because that was, you know, that was all him really. And the new CEO, who is well, he's internal, he was running the Asian business for a long time. Wow, he is so impressive, and I feel a lot more conviction around this story now. There, so I think there's a lot of self-help there. You know, it's a great platform. They've got great products. When you, the kind of easiest one for me to understand is when you are buying something online. And, you know, years ago, you had to type in your address to every single box, and that was quite tedious. And then you could, there was an innovation where you could type in your postcode and then and do a lookup, and then you could select it from a drop down box. That was great. Now you can just start typing your address and then it auto fills it for you. Mm. That's all GB software. So you're probably using GB software. I know I am. Many, many times a week when I'm buying things online without knowing it. So it helps businesses to understand who they're transacting with, and it helps customers to use online transaction sites in a more, you know, in a more sort of frictionless way. So there's nothing more annoying than having to, you know, constantly fill in those forms when you're trying to buy something. But also businesses need to know, actually, that address is linked to high levels of fraud across other companies. So other companies report that address often leads to a fraudulent transaction. So, I mean, that is great information for a business to know. So this is huge in banks, in retail customer, retail businesses, so that they have a better chance of, you know, generating profitable sales. Yeah. But yeah, so lots of self-help now, I would say. They've never really been very good at pricing, I think. So they've not really focused on pricing a lot. And, you know, in a software business, pricing is, you know, one of the main levers for driving your growth outside, you know, kind of new products and market growth. So I think now that they can focus on that a little bit, that will be really, that will be very instructive to see what value they're able to extract there. They have now arranged so that commissions that are paid to the sales team, they actually will incentivize the sales team to sell all the products of GB Group, not just the one that they were used to selling. So if you were selling that address verification software, now you will also be incentivized to sell the fraud or the identity piece as well, and the other way around. So again, I think that will be useful. And the result, we're seeing the results start to come through already. NRR, net recurring net revenue retention, is above 100%, and that's kind of the key for software businesses like this as well. So I think a more simplified business for customers to deal with, yes, but also for investors to get their head around. They've kind of sharpened the message. I think it has been a rocky few years. I think we'll get operating leverage from that volume growth, and I think the valuation is pretty underwhelming for that growth.
Yeah, I think the other growth driver actually is because you've got open banking now, and there's a lot of the challenger online banks, the likes of Revolut and Wise and people like that. And they basically, obviously, GB Group do all the checking, the ID verification, the know your customer sort of stuff. And so within about a couple of hours of putting your application to get a credit card or to get a debit card from these guys, it comes through because GB Group have done it all online for them, because it's all, now they can get that open banking data straight from the source, from your NatWest or wherever it is. So
exactly. Yeah. It's such a good process, isn't it, as a customer? Yeah. Being able to do, you take the picture, the selfie.
Yes, exactly.
You take pictures of your ID front and back, and then it's done. And compare that to, I'm trying to close an account at the moment with a high street bank, and it's, they want the, birth certificate.
Yeah.
Inside leg measurement, everything. It's absolute agony. And then, you can do it in minutes, kind of sitting on the bus with one of the challenger banks. So, yeah, all thanks to that great KYC software.
Yeah, when I was signing up to Wise, unfortunately, when I did my selfie, they said, sod off, you ugly mug. So they were a bit reticent. Anyway, they eventually gave me, after a bit of arm twisting. Okay, let's move to the industrial sector. We've got Rotork, which is a world leader in actuators, which I think are sort of like devices that do linear motion in all kinds of different industries mining and all kinds of different stuff. Done really, really well long term. What's your latest thoughts on this one? High quality company.
Very high quality company. Yes. Yeah, so the actuators, they control whether a valve is open or shut, to what degree it's open and shut, all of those things. So anything that needs to flow, which might go through a pipe and have a valve attached to it, then you might want an actuator on top of that. And it's very highly regulated industries that they've focused on. So chemicals, water, power, oil and gas. So you can see, again, growing markets. Even oil and gas is in growth because they have focused a lot on the LNG market, LNG, which is the kind of growthy area here. And then water, power, chemicals, obviously in massive growth. It's one of the highest return on capital businesses in the sector, and the industrial sector is full of very high return on capital businesses. It's the reason why this is our largest overweight sector. Rotork has very strong margins because these bits of kit are very niche. They are absolutely essential. If you don't have it, you're in trouble. You're not going to go for a cheaper one. A cheaper Chinese provider. You need this to work perfectly. So they've even got some recurring revenue now. They add kind of services on top, which is a nice kicker. They've got cash on the balance sheet that gives them options. And we've seen that this year. They've launched another buyback and they did a little deal. And I think they'll probably do a few more deals, infills and things like that. So, we're talking a lot on the desk at the moment about how having net cash on the balance sheet is just such a benefit to our companies. We understand capital allocation theory, where you don't want your balance sheet to be inefficient. But actually, the world is so fast changing and so unpredictable and volatile that actually having that cash on the balance sheet just gives you so much flexibility. It just gives you this underpin of optionality, where your control, your destiny is really in your control. Parable of the 6 foot tall man who drowned in the river that was on average 3 feet deep. If you're in a business that's quite cyclical, then the more leverage you have on the balance sheet, the more likely you are to kind of find yourself in one of these time periods where that leverage is a huge, huge pain. And investors are becoming much more, well, not much more. We're always leverage sensitive, but you know, you can feel it in any kind of market sell-off. You know what people do? They just rank their assets by highest to lowest leverage and they start selling at the top. So it really is, you know, that net cash is really important. Anyway, we digress. Rotork.
You're exactly right. I get so much, you know, you hear these finance directors on some companies which are over leveraged and you say to them, don't go above 2x EBITDA. It just isn't making sense in this environment. And they come back and say things like, oh, if I was in the private equity, if I was run by a, you know, sort of a VC, then I'd be on flipping 4 or 5x. And I say to them, you do that in a public environment and it's a totally different game. You're going to get totally shitty. So I'm going to use your logic when it comes to speaking to these CFOs trying to justify really high levels of leverage.
Yeah. You know, you can see how powerful a buyback strategy has been in the UK the last couple of years. It's such a clear differentiator. The stocks that have outperformed, so many of them will be doing a buyback so that at least someone is out there buying the shares.
Yeah. OK, let's move to the last one in the industrial sector. Another very, very high quality company that people should definitely put onto their stock watch. Oxford Instruments, for really sort of unique precision measuring devices for healthcare, semiconductors, industrials, etc. I think the healthcare is still suffering from a bit of destocking, if I remember. But the semis are now starting to come back. How do you see this one? Very, very good quality business.
Yeah, it's seriously cutting edge. They, as you say, they've got those very kind of forward-looking technology areas. They enable companies and also scientific research communities to analyze, image, manipulate materials down to the atomic and molecular level. So, you know, this stuff is way above my pay grade. They've gone through this huge investment process of investment plan, heavy investment at Severn Beach, for example. So I think now we're at this stage where, again, a bit like Treat, you know, you put this capex in and now it's time to harvest the returns. So I want to see that coming through. I want to see those orders coming through, or you know, order pipeline. They've got a new CEO here, so who I think is much more commercial, probably. You know, when you're servicing the scientific research community, I think it's very easy to get into some kind of pet projects and, you know, take a product and sort of make it quite bespoke and, you know, try and solve these really interesting thorny problems alongside the research community. And that's great, but it's probably not great for shareholder returns, or not as good for shareholder returns as it could be with a slightly sharper focus on commercialization. So I think there's that piece which can definitely be tightened up. And then there's the kind of cost side as well, you know, operating efficiencies within the business. So I think we've got a chance to do that with the new CEO.
Yeah, good. What's the sort of organic growth going forward? I would have thought in this really high value precision, you'd get at least 3% pricing and probably 3% volume. It should be a mid to high single digit grower, I'd have thought, you'd have, for a high quality business.
Yeah, it definitely should. We've been a bit disappointed with, well, so the what they've done really successfully is with the export controls over these high-end products into China, they've had to essentially stop exporting a lot of that stuff to China and replace that. But they've very successfully replaced that work with new work. So, I mean, I think that's hugely impressive performance. But I think there's definitely some more. It should be able to do more organic growth, I would say. There's a whole part of the division as well that isn't making a lot of profit. So, sorry, a whole part of the business, a whole division that isn't really making any profit. So any kind of increase there from very, very low levels actually could have quite a material impact on the profit line. Oxford Nanopore a couple of weeks ago came out and said that their NIH funding post-inauguration has been cut, or has been paused, I think they said. And so
that's NIH's healthcare US, isn't it?
Exactly. And so that could be, you know, Trump has signed all these executive orders pausing and cutting and all of this stuff. So I think we have to watch out there and see what Oxford say. I think they've got numbers this week, possibly. But the thing about Oxford is, as you say, they've got this incredible technology, you know, Nobel Prize winners use Oxford Instruments technology. You know, this is a business that, you know, really will go somewhere, or has the ability to go somewhere. Spectris, if you remember, made an approach for it, and you'll be able to see that on the chart there. It's probably that piece there. A few years ago, and were rebuffed, but actually I could see possibly even more logic in that deal happening now, and the valuation differential is even is even bigger now. So definitely this one could be taken out. That would be really disappointing for, you know, UK PLC, I would say, to lose a company like Oxford. But again, you know, if we're not going to value these things properly, then
I was looking at it, and it trades at only, I mean, it's got a good solid balance sheet. Is it just over 10 times EBITDA for, you know, sort of say probably trough earnings, etc., with long term? And I mean, I'd certainly say if they come out with a cautious outlook statement because of, say, the Trump measures and the Doge initiatives out in the States, then there'll be plenty of smart, canny investors and fund managers, I'm sure, increasing their position. So
it's one of those battles between that long, you know, long term. They are in exactly the right areas. They've got these incredible products, which, you know, no one else has, and would love to get their hands on this kind of imaging and analysis technology. But in the short term, there are some headwinds, I think. So, yeah, it's one of those kind of tensions, and what do you do, and how, you know, for me, how do you place that in a 50 stock portfolio?
Yeah. Well, that's a nice job to decide. Just one final question, then, Alexandra, which I ask everybody: what's the sort of the one stock that sort of gets the blood racing for the rest of the year, for the next sort of 12, 18 months, that you would sort of like want to highlight as just a total idea to people from your portfolio or any other stock?
Oh, that's a good question. I think Raspberry Pi is definitely one to watch. There's lots, you know, there's lots happening there. But as we said, the valuation is quite spicy. There's a stock called Boku, which is AIM listed. Oh, okay. So possibly, and it's also US incorporated or domiciled. I forget which, but that stops some fund managers from being able to own it. I think we talked possibly about it last
time.
That's
a payments business, isn't it, over the mobile?
Exactly, which is such a... you know, such a growth market. So if you are in the developing world, you probably don't have a bank account, but you definitely have a mobile phone. So you'll put a lot of your subscriptions, your Netflix subscription or your Spotify subscription or your Amazon, you'd put that through your mobile phone bill rather than your bank account because you don't have one. So they are in such a good space in the payments space. But the shares are not, and they've upgraded numbers. Amazon have got some warrants in the business, so, you know, Amazon really believe in the potential of this company in terms of what payment volume that they will, processing volume that Amazon expect that they will put through Boku's network. And the shares, I think possibly because it's AIM listed, you know, it's not getting the recognition it deserves, but that is definitely one that I am excited about.
Brilliant. Okay, we'll keep that on the watch list as well. So thanks very much again, Alexandra, for all your fantastic insights. Thanks, everyone, for your questions as well. And look forward to chatting again in 6 months' time.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.